state workers won't face a locked office on July 1st because lawmakers finished an operating budget 8 days before a government shutdown. Why was it so tough to get this done? And what does it indicate for future legislative negotiations for the state's long-term fiscal stability? Is the partisan divide larger than in the past, or are there comparisons from other legislative slugfests that can provide insight for the future? We're discussing lessons learned and ideas for breaking gridlock today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Alaska lawmakers have certainly dealt with years when low oil prices presented a financial crisis and partisan tempers grew short as reserves drained away. When dollars are tight, families fight. But to keep the Alaska government household in order and stable, broad compromise may be needed to avoid a loss of federal dollars and another downgrade from credit rating agencies. So what does it take? Our guests today are not marriage counselors, but they do know about working across philosophical divides. Mike Navar is the Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor, a business owner, and a former Democratic lawmaker who served in the House starting in 1984. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming up. And Andrew Helcrow is the CEO of the Anchorage Community Development Authority. He is also a business owner and a former Republican member of the House, first elected in 1998. Hello.
Good morning, Lori. How are you?
I am well. Thanks so much to both of you for being here. And you out there in Radio Land can also join our conversation today. Are you happy, relieved, or steamed up about what the legislature did with the budget? Do you think they should keep working and get other business like a capital budget done, or do they need a break? Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's start with the basics. Lawmakers were able to eke together a compromise operating budget, but no one seemed particularly happy with it or what they had to give up. So just give me your basic impression about how well they did or did not do in crafting this. Mike, let's start with you.
You know, I think at the end of the day, the budget that they came out with was a reasonably good compromise. The problem is they didn't generate any new revenues to help pay for that. So it's all going to be paid for out of savings. And that's really of concern over the long term. We've had a need for a long-range fiscal plan for the last 30 years. And they didn't do anything to address that, I think. And those are tough decisions. There's a lot of philosophical differences between the House and the Senate on what new revenues should be utilized. And so that's tied in with the politics of new taxes and new revenues and the fact that we haven't had to pay any taxes at the state level for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Helcrow, your thoughts, your basic thoughts about what happened.
Sure. It's interesting because Mike and I both served in the legislature at a time when oil crashed. Oil was single digits, billion-dollar budget deficits. So this is very familiar to both of us. And the arguments against a fiscal plan and some of the ideas are no different than the ideas we heard 15, 20 years ago. You know, a lottery, you know, this, that, or the other thing. I mean, it just simply doesn't work. I think one of the things I'm most disappointed about is the dialogue. I mean, you have some lawmakers who stand up and say, we need a fiscal plan, has to be comprehensive. The governor comes to mind, who I think has done a hell of a job with leadership. I mean, this is a guy who got elected billions in deficits facing, and he has been a leader trying to get the legislature to not only accept the fact that they have to make hard decisions, but actually creating a roadmap for them to do it. And I think the most frustrating thing from the last session was the dialogue. I mean, we've pitted this against permanent fund earnings versus income tax versus cuts to the budget. I mean, one of the frustrating things is there are at least a half a dozen members of the legislature that were there 16 years ago when we had these same conversations. These men and women who were there 16 years ago know how this story ends. But what you hear from them during the legislative session is, don't worry, we can whistle past the graveyard another couple of days, or another couple of years. That doesn't work. I mean, this state has to have a serious conversation about Alaskans beginning to pay for the government they get.
You know, you queued up very nicely my next question, because you're talking about the dialogue. And there was some very unusual language used during the debate on June 15th. When Representative Dan Sadler compared the House majority's budget moves with the attack on Pearl Harbor, Representative Lance Pruitt welcoming House Speaker Bryce Edgman to the Club of Tyrants, and Senator David Wilson compared the House majority's tactics to the racist Jim Crow laws. How would you compare this language to what you heard when you were in the legislature? Do you have any ideas about cooling down this animosity? And what's the context here? I mean, some of this hyperbole, these comments seem sort of over the top, do they not?
Yeah,
Mike Navarre.
They were clearly over the top, but at the same time, it was frustration that was being expressed. That was seeing the legislature really at its worst. The House majority was very frustrated with the negotiations with the Senate, and at the end of the day, what they decided to do was make a strategic move, roll everything into one budget, and pass it over the objections of the minority or without the cooperation of the minority in the House, and that leads to bad feelings. It's not the way to do things. But again, they were at a real logjam there, and something had to happen. And so hopefully, as we saw when the session finally ended, there was much more cooperation. A budget passed with a large majority in both the House and the Senate, which is, I think, represents the fact that they came to a reasonable compromise at the end of the day. And, you know, they were tired. They'd been there a long time. They were frustrated with things that were going on. And so hopefully we won't see that again.
Yeah, Andrew Velcro, Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I think the rhetoric this year, at least on that evening where the House kind of combined everything, the rhetoric was way over the top. I mean, you know, Mike and I have both been on the floor of the House and, you know, dealt with amendments until 2-3 in the morning. And, you know, nobody ever, I mean, even at their worst times, nobody ever used this kind of rhetoric. You know, granted, it's tough for the minority because they've been in the majority for 2 decades, and now suddenly they're realizing what it's like on the other side of the street to be locked out of the process. I think the disappointing takeaway from the legislative session is that, you know, the House majority, I feel, I understand they're frustrated, but the lesson that we need to learn is 10 years ago at the end of session, you know, the hostage was education funding. Right. I mean, that was the hostage. Right. There's always hostages at the end of session for leverage. You've gotten to the point now where those prisoners at the end of the session are far more costly than education funding. I mean, last year, the governor slashed half the dividend, this year again. So as we progress the next couple of years, these end of session games are going to get worse because there's less to use for leverage. And Alaskans will pay the price.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing ways to find compromise for the state's future, for fiscal stability. My guests are Andrew Helcrow, he's a former Republican House member, and Mike Navarre, who is a former Democrat House member. They're in the studio with me. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to the phones. Jim is in Eagle River. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to discuss revenue. From the beginning, it was demonstrably clear that cuts alone were not sufficient to balance the budget. My Republican legislator and most of the others as well said, well, we don't want to talk about revenue until we cut. There's more cuts to be made. And it seems the only revenue they were agree to was cutting the permanent fund dividend. And the reason that they were opposed to the income tax, I was told, is the economy is down and we don't want to put additional downward pressure on the economy and the hardworking people who make it, so we don't want to impose an income tax, when in fact the permanent fund dividend cut, the most regressive tax there could be, would have a much wider and greater impact on the economy. My question, nobody likes taxes per se, but in this case, it just seems necessary. Income tax seems the fairest way. Is there any way to move Republicans on that issue?
Thank you, Jim, for the question. Andrew Helcro,
looking at the Republican in the room,
resident Republican.
I mean, Jim. I mean, what you've brought up is really a legitimate public policy argument, and again, it gets back to my initial comments about being frustrated with the dialogue. Look, as far back as Jay Hammett, everybody recognizes that when somebody moves into the state of Alaska, they cost the state money: roads, troopers, schools, a dividend. The state collects nothing in return. So, you know, when you look at, you know, these arguments about contributing for government, it's only going to get worse as the population grows. I mean, the fastest two demographics growing in Alaska are seniors and children, which are the two most expensive demographics for government to support. So, you know, the reality is you have to get to the point where Alaskans get to the right conversation. And that right conversation is the same one that was 15 years ago, same one that was 20, 25 years ago. You need a broad-based tax. People have to start contributing to the cost of government, okay? Oil can no longer cover the bills. So the debate is sales tax, income tax, or whatever else. That's the conversation you need to have. So maybe you don't need an income tax this year or next year, but you certainly need to sit down and start having a conversation about the future. Because when you delve into sales tax versus income tax, there's a lot of pros and cons, and there's a lot of things about a sales tax that people don't realize that will affect other tax burdens that they have. So that's the conversation that needs to happen to move, I would say, Republicans and Democrats to make a decision on what broad-based tax Alaskans should pay.
Well, and I want your thoughts on this, Mike, as well, but I think that it's important to point out that any state sales tax is going to be layered over local taxes, right, that a lot of communities already have. They have the ability to have local taxes. So if you've already got 5 or 7% locally, right, and you put another 3, 4, 5% on top of that, yikes.
Right. And that's the thing. If we're going to talk about a sales tax, it really needs to be studied a little bit more and looked at in that context. I think there's 105 different sales tax jurisdictions around the state, and they're all a little bit different in what they exempt, in the level of those sales taxes. And so there will be impacts by layering another level of sales tax, including probably pushing people to even more internet sales, which has been growing over a period of time. I wanted to touch on a couple of things that Andrew talked about. The permanent fund was set up a long time ago, and really the dividends came 4 years after the permanent fund was set up, because what the permanent fund was designed to do was take a non-renewable resource, which was oil, and turn it into a renewable resource at some point in the future when we needed it. The reason oil can't pay for everything now is that production from when it peaked in 1988 in Alaska at 2 million barrels a day. Now it's down to about 500,000 barrels a day. And so just from an economy of scale, it's a much smaller number that you're multiplying by. Additionally, we're seeing increased competition from the lower 48. We used to see competition for oil development funds and investment from countries overseas and Middle East and all over the planet. Now, the United States is our biggest competition. The Permian Basin, the Bakken's in North Dakota, Permian Basin in Texas. And because it's getting cheaper and cheaper to do that type of oil development, fracking, tight oil, things like that. That's where our competition is coming from. So if we want to get competition and investment in Alaska, oil dollar investment in Alaska, we have to be attractive to them. And that's why we can't put the whole burden on them anymore. One other thing I just wanted to talk about, and that was, the governor cut the dividend in half a year ago. He vetoed half the dividend. That was a very courageous move. It was definitely not the right politics, but it was the right fiscal decision for Alaska. We can't have the single biggest asset that the state has now, which is its permanent fund, only going to pay out dividends, because there are consequences and costs associated with that. So I think the governor did the right thing, and I think the fact that the legislature appropriated funds for an $1,100 dividend this year instead of a $2,000 dividend also recognizes that we can't continue only to pay out dividends from the earnings of the permanent fund.
It's interesting that you're both agreeing that the governor's choice was the
reasonable.
Right choice.
Yeah. Well, and I wanted, because Mike hit on something, brilliant, because I hear this from, and I'm going to get very parochial here, talking about Anchorage. I hear a lot of my neighbors say, oh, we need a sales tax. I mean, let's step back and take a look at this. First off, you've got, as Mike said, over 100 sales tax jurisdictions. Sales tax is predominantly a local form of revenue because the city of Anchorage can't levy an income tax. So sales tax is traditionally reserved for local communities. And as you said, if Wrangell's at 7% and the state comes in with 3%, then you're at 10%, right? But with Anchorage, it's a little bit different. So those in Anchorage that support a statewide sales tax, let me just appeal this to you. Also, one of the biggest arguments I hear is that property taxes are too high. Mm. Okay, the only way the city is going to mitigate property taxes is to diversify revenue, which is a sales tax. So if the state passes a 3% sales tax, do you really believe that the voters of Anchorage are going to approve another 2 or 3% sales tax on top of that? No. Which means what? Which means you're going to default to continue paying 60 cents out of every dollar the city spends from property owners. So when people say they want a sales tax, they need to understand that it's going to have a dramatic effect on the city's ability to generate revenue.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Carl is in Anchorage. Hi, Carl.
Good morning. I'm calling here from Anchorage, but I wanted to remind Andrew Halcrow that several years ago, he came out to speak to the Chamber of Commerce in Bethel, and I took him around, and we went to the college, and he spoke to one of the classes there, and had a chance to visit our community at the time.
That was a great experience, and I can't thank you enough. It was fabulous. It was actually the first time I'd been to Bethel, so thank you.
That's right, it was. In any case, I'm calling about revenue as well, but it's a different kind of revenue. You know, we have a big bunch of people who don't live in Alaska, but have their jobs and their livelihood here, and they commute back and forth to places in the lower 48, spend a couple of weeks working here, go back home, and don't pay a dime in any kind of cost that we incur for them. And yet nobody on the Republican side seems to want to acknowledge that. They always talk about, we have to cut things. Well, what do we have to cut? I don't hear any specifics. If I heard some specifics, I guess I'd be a little more interested in that approach. But, I lived here many, many years ago when we did pay income tax, and I was happy to contribute because where I lived before, that was just something you did. Hmm. You paid for the cost of the government. We had skin in the game. And frankly, I think until we solve that issue, we need to have a source of revenue for the state. We can't just keep cutting and... I'm sorry if the politicians feel they're going to lose the next election if they do it, but I think they have to do it. We are to that point now where we can't just keep cutting. We have to raise some revenue.
Well, let's talk about that point.
The way to do it would be with a state income tax, a modest state income tax.
Right.
I know they complain that it'll grow. Well, maybe it will.
Well, thank you, Carl, for raising that. And is there a way to, if they wanted to sort of ease their way into this income tax idea, can you start with a tax on visiting workers only, or is that not constitutionally sound? You can't do that. Nope. I'm seeing heads shaking no on both sides.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so it has to be an income tax.
We'd have done that a long time ago.
For visitors
charge
and
the other guys, pass the savings on to us.
But, you know, Carl brings up an interesting point that there are people who come in here, work. A lot of them make probably higher wages than a lot of people who are in state, some of them do at least. What do you think should happen in that respect? Would that be quite a boon for the state if we put an income tax in and got more revenue from these visiting workers? I mean, we hear that a lot, but how much would that really translate into? Does anyone really know?
It's about 20% of what would be generated, I think, is the most recent number, would be generated from workers who are residents of someplace outside who earn their income in Alaska. So it's fairly significant. About one-fifth of it would be paid by out-of-state residents. You know, the important thing about having a diversified state tax base and a plan in place is that, you know, in order to get out of an economic recession, it requires investment. If you spend down all of your savings and then go to taxes, you stretch out the period that recession lasts, and it's the stagnation in the economy. Whereas if you put a plan in place that's a reasonable plan that supports the costs of state government, then you can use some of those in savings dollars to invest in the economy. We haven't had a real capital budget in Alaska in about 4 years, which means that the funding that was put in place then is all trickled through, takes about 5-6 years to run through. That's why we're losing construction jobs. That's why the economy is contracting in that particular industry. And it's going to, I think, get worse before it gets better. We have a lot of deferred maintenance around the state, billions and billions of dollars of deferred maintenance that we could utilize some of our savings to take care of that, or spend money or go out and bond for some of those projects. But you can't do that unless you have the ability and revenues to pay for it. And that's the problem now, is that we're spending down our reserves and we're sort of compromising our future by doing so.
Well, and bonding is also tentatively at risk if our credit rating gets lowered again, if we are not considered fiscally sound by the big rating agencies.
Well, and I want to touch on, because I think this is really important, because it's one of the false narratives that's out there that we can cut our way out of this. And the previous caller just made a brilliant point that I always see in the paper. Whenever there is a interview with a lawmaker, a senior lawmaker, usually the finance co-chair, right? The question is from every reporter, okay, you want to cut the budget. Where are you going to cut the budget? And the answer is always, well, you know, IT, or, you know, some vague notion of some area where we're going to cut the budget, right? Now, bear in mind, the people they're talking to are the finance co-chairs. These are the people that build the budgets every year. So if they don't know where to cut when they built the budget, that shows, I mean, it certainly to me, it shows that they've pretty much cut all they can. And matter of fact, I heard a Valley lawmaker on another radio program this morning talking about how there needs to be additional investment in state troopers. But you have to reconcile that with her and all of her other colleagues talking about how much fat there is in the state government. So, you know, this idea about cuts, yes, every government has room to trim. But when you talk about cuts, so you're going to cut education, does that mean we're not going to invest in education anymore? I mean, because you obviously have demands, education, a growing population, those kinds of things. So when people say budget cuts, it's like, okay, that works today, but what about tomorrow? What about next week? I mean, the state's going to be in business in 100 years.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Phil is in Fairbanks. Hi, Phil.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My point also is a revenue, towards the revenue side of this. I heard a previous caller talk about the people that come and work in our state and then go somewhere else to live. And it's not just oil field workers. There is a ton of people in tourism, fishing, probably timber. I'm not sure of all the categories, but it is far-reaching. I think I heard a 20% number. Our workers are 20% out of state, maybe. Anyway, all things aside, it's our case in Alaska is similar to others. We can look at Detroit, the state of Illinois, and even the federal system. Everybody is running short of money. Now, if I do that, I don't have any choice. I can't spend anymore. So I realize that there are different ways to garner funds to support different programs within government and so on. But in Alaska's case, you know, I heard someone earlier also state that we need to explore ways to get more money from the federal government. Well, I'm sorry, but that is running out as well. The programs are looked at from outside like, wow, why are they doing that in Alaska? And I can only imagine that pressure will be brought to bear by this administration, rightfully or wrongfully, I'm not going to judge. But that funding source may be drying up as well, because when you look at the amount of taxes they collect and they still spend more, it's a spending problem as much of, as it's a revenue issue.
All right. Well, thanks, Phil. You've given us a lot to think about. And I want to stick with the phones for just a moment. We're going to take another call. This is one of the current lawmakers. Representative Jason Gren is on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Well, did you want to? Did you have a question, or did you want to wait?
One, I wanted to say, hello to a constituent of mine who's on with you now, Mr. Andrew Helcrow, and wanted to just let people know, you know, even though there's not a lot of action in Juneau right now, there's still a lot of work happening behind the scenes. We're still working on, you know, we passed a budget that was a kind of a 1-year compromise to avert our shutdown, but we really are focused on a long-term fiscal plan. You know, every economist, every expert, everyone we talk to says that a long-term fiscal plan is a must, and not some vague idea that we can kind of keep kicking down the road for another 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. This is something that you have a lot of people in Juneau who are really working on this and really dedicated to finding a long-term solution that slows our recession and keeps Alaskans here and our quality of life as we expect it to be. So just, you know, encourage people to connect with their lawmakers during kind of this slow time of our second special session, but make sure that people are reaching out and letting their lawmakers know how they feel about what's going on right now.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call. And long-term fiscal plan is...
I appreciate that. And that's one of the frictions that's in place in Juneau right now, is that the House majority is adamantly committed to a long-range fiscal plan and to getting the tools in place that really, I think, provide opportunity well into the future for our economy and for investors, et cetera, in Alaska. So that's part of the problem, is that the Senate seems to be willing to bet that the oil price is going to come back. And in fact, the budget this year that they passed is based on, I think, almost $55 per barrel. And right now we're hovering at about $45 mm-hmm. a barrel, and the fiscal year hasn't even started. There's way more downward pressure on oil right now than there is upward pressure. And the reason for that, again, is all of the huge oil finds in the lower 48 that are tight oil or shale oil in the Permian Basin. And this is just for perspective. You know, Prudhoe Bay is a huge oil field, the largest ever discovered in North America. However, the Permian Basin has almost about 10 times as much oil in place as Prudhoe Bay. That's significant. Now, it's a different type of drilling, shale. It's, you got to drill more wells. So we have more conventional oil up here. We're still going to be able to attract investment, but we have a lot of competition now.
Mm-hmm. And, excuse me. And one of the previous callers talked about needing lawmakers that stood up and did the right thing regardless of re-election. And I'm going to take 30 seconds here and talk about my legislator, Representative Jason Gren. I think he has been an unbelievable leader his freshman year. He has stood up. He got elected as he's a Republican turned independent. He got elected in Sand Lake. He has spent a lot of time in the neighborhoods talking with constituents. His town hall meetings are always full. This is a guy who told me when he first got into the race, look, I'm here to do the right thing. I'm not here to get reelected. And I have to say that if there were more lawmakers like, you know, Representative Jason Gren, people who stood up and said, look, these are tough decisions. You might not like the decisions I make, but I guarantee you whoever sits in my chair after I leave, the decisions are going to get worse. And that's the kind of leadership we need. And so, Jason, a shout out to you, because I've been more than impressed. And I've been watching the legislature for a long time. And I think you have a handful of lawmakers in Juneau that are really emerging as leaders.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll take your calls, your questions, as we look for ways forward for the state's fiscal stability as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Our discussion today is finding compromise for state stability and fiscal certainty into the future. My guests are Andrew Helcrow, former Republican House member, and Mike Navar, former Democrat House member, both in the studio here in Anchorage. And you can join us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go back to the phones. Gil is in Homer. Hi, Gil.
Good morning.
Did you have a question?
Governor Jay Hammond, when he, when the state legislature rescinded the income tax in Alaska, warned all of us of the danger of that. And now we are paying the price for that. We cannot cut our way out of this fiscal issue. We must get some, as voters, we need to get some skin in the game. We don't pay for state government right now. So our legislators, listen to those people who do, and come to us on election day and ask for our vote. We need some skin in the game, and they will listen more closely.
You're talking about constituents will listen more closely if they have skin in the game?
Well, the legislature will. I feel they, we aren't paying our fair share. We expect industry only to pay for our bills in this state.
So you want an income tax? Is that what you're saying?
That's certainly.
I feel it will make my legislators more responsible to the electorate if we are paying the bills and will pay more attention to the budget.
Yes, and this is the second time we've heard today on the program "Skin in the Game." So, Mike Navar.
You know, and I think you're correct, Gil, but the part of the problem I think is that we do pay taxes at the local level, and so we think we're paying for the cost of services, and we are. At the local level. But at the state level, we're not paying anything, or very little, I should say, into the cost of delivering government services. And there's always talk about cut the budget, cut the budget, cut the budget. Government's too big, it's bloated, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, we have a process in place that addresses that. The legislature meets every year to pass a budget. And I can tell you that the ones who are fiscally conservative or say they're fiscally conservative, they don't want things cut in their district. In fact, they want additional services sometimes in their district. The two biggest items we have in the state budget are education, which is about $1.3 billion, and health and social services, which is about $1.1 billion. Mm-hmm. That's almost two-thirds of our entire budget in those two categories. That's why it's difficult to cut government. Other areas have already been reduced, particularly the capital budget.
Yes. Would you like to add in here, Andrew Hellcroft?
I think the idea of skin in the game is something that, as we talked about, that's what Jay Hammond said. And you go back and you talk to, you know, the great leaders, Hammond, Arliss Sverdlovsky, and they'll tell you the same thing. Look, even if we would have left the income tax on the books for 0.1%, at least it still would have been there and you wouldn't have had this political battle. But I want to point something out because, you know, this is a common refrain about, you know, I don't get anything for state spending or I don't benefit from any services. I live in Sand Lake. I work downtown. I drive the same five roads every day. Every one of those roads are maintained by the men and women of the Department of Transportation, the state, not the city. And for what I pay in gas tax, it's the same amount as 1961. Now, I wasn't even born until 64, and most of the major arterials in this city weren't built until 70 and 71 when oil, you know, made old the new Seward and Minnesota and all those. So, I mean, when you look at the fact that I am paying the same gas tax today as they adopted in 1961 and all of the growth, I mean, it shows you what a magnificent free ride we've had, but the string was inevitably going to run out.
Mike Navarre.
And we pay for education at the local level, but two-thirds of the cost of education is paid for at the state level, and we don't pay anything there. That's something that I think is often missed, is that when we see cuts at the state level, whether it's revenue sharing, whether it's education, whether it's bond debt reimbursement, that directly impacts us locally and either results in an increase in local taxes or a reduction in services at the local level.
Right. And you know, Lori, I just want to say I get the arguments. I mean, you know, people, this is an expensive place to live. You know, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, top three most expensive healthcare markets in the country, right? We're under significant pressure because of the cost of living. So when you talk about taking dividends or you talk about new taxes, people naturally get like, you hunker down, right? But this is a conversation about the state. Right. I mean, this is a conversation about, OK, we know we have oil, more oil potential on the North Slope. That's going to take 10 to 12 years. What do we do to bridge the gap, mm-hmm. to keep our schools strong and to keep our community safe? And some of the things that we're seeing and people are experiencing all over the community, the increase in petty crime and some of the brashness, this has a lot to do with our inability to invest in infrastructure, whether it's education or whether it's rehabilitation services for opioid addiction. I mean, whether you like it or not, government has a role. And if government doesn't play that role, those costs get shifted to the public by way of crime and bad roads and everything else.
Let's go back to the phones. Chansey is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hi there. I am listening to the two guests, and I don't have any overall solution, but I do have a couple of comments I'd like to make. I agree that Hammond said that we needed skin in the game, and it's a shame he didn't veto the bill that repealed the income tax. But one thing that Hammond did do back in the 70s was appoint a commission, called it a little Hoover Commission, that had been done at the federal level, where you get together financial accountants and the like that can look at how you're performing and whether you're getting your money's worth for expenditures. And I would like to see Governor Walker do that again before the next session, because there's always going to be this argument. You know, I'm willing to pay taxes, but I'm not willing to pay taxes for this wasteful government. You need to establish periodically that the government is operating as efficiently as you can expect it. And if you have a commission that does that, it kind of takes away the argument that we don't need to have an income tax. We do need to have an income tax because people don't really appreciate things in the long run that they get for free. And if you have skin in the game, that makes a difference in your attitude. The second thing is we need to abandon reliance on a severance tax on oil and gas. It's way too volatile. I wrote an op-ed piece that showed the Pew Trust had
looked at states that rely on the severance tax for more than 5% of their revenue, and of the 9 states that do it, severance tax in 6 of the 9 states was the most volatile source of income. In the other 3, which includes Alaska, it was the second most volatile. It's just tremendously unpredictable. We need to have a property tax on oil and gas. We can get our fair share, but we have to recognize the severance tax is not the way to do it. And if we had a property tax, you could do some planning. You could have some stability in the income. You don't have to look at the paper each morning to see how much money you might be getting out of a severance tax. You can do it. You can actually have some forward funding of education, which, by the way, is the one thing that the Constitution says the state has an obligation to fund.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chancey Croft, former lawmaker as well. Reactions to his thoughts about what the way forward should be. Mike?
Part of the frustration is going back to what I said, the mixed messaging. And as a Republican, you know, a lot of my fellow Republicans are supported by the business industry, right? And I don't think there has been a more schizophrenic industry than the business industry, than the business community. One day you'll see an op-ed in the paper from three leading business figures saying, adopt the governor's compromise, got to get a fiscal plan. The next day you'll read a story in the paper about some splinter group doing ads attacking lawmakers who are actually working on a fiscal solution. And what's amazing to me is these business leaders simply don't understand that when you look at the economy, and everybody talks about private sector job losses, a lot of those job losses came because the legislature's huge capital budgets over 4 or 5 years created a false economy. I mean, you spent $100 million building the Alaska Airlines Center. That project's no longer in the pipeline. And as Mike said, you know, another year or so, that capital money is going to flow through. And so you have to have a consistent message instead of having these business groups saying, yeah, do something, and the other one saying, we're going to attack you if you do something.
But is that what it takes is for us to get to that point where we've been talking for the last year or so about once all those capital project dollars get through cycling through the multi-year process that they're in, then the crunch really will be felt by a much broader cross-section of the population. And do we need to get to that point of desperation before people are willing to come along? Mike Navarre.
You know, that's one of the frustrations I have, is that sometimes it seems like we can't get to things until we're in an absolute crisis. And whether or not we're in a crisis now, we are on the cusp of a real crisis in Alaska, because there's other things that I think the public hasn't recognized that's been done by the legislature. We talked about bonding a little bit. We're seeing our bond rating erode, and I think we're going to see it erode even further. That affects not just the state level, but local governments as well.
Right.
The other thing that the state did a couple of years ago is they removed the reimbursement for bonds for local construction projects for schools, major maintenance, so that we could maintain our schools. And so that was repealed, and it doesn't, I think it's repealed until 2020. So that takes money out of the economy, and it just defers maintenance, which ends up manifesting as major capital projects and additional costs if you don't properly maintain. So some of those things were just, I think the public doesn't recognize, has already happened. As far as getting a group together, I fully support getting a group together to help encourage and report to the legislature, business, economists, et cetera, that can analyze some of these things and help the legislature analyze it. Because part of the problem in the legislature is that there's a lot of extraordinary people in the legislature, a lot of really good people. But the truth is, it's not the best and brightest. It's just the people who happen to run for office. When I first got elected in 84, I thought I was going down there amongst real legislators. I had a little bit of a crisis in confidence. But when I got down there and I started meeting people, what I found out is it's just people. You get a group of 60 people, put them together, and you have really smart people, some who are not so smart, all different kinds of experiences, different backgrounds, educations, et cetera. And so it's a dynamic process, but they get caught up oftentimes between politics and policy. Mm. And that's where some of the confusion reigns. And so I think that getting a consensus among business and community leaders about a responsible approach is critical to helping the legislature step up to the plate. And I have to say that the House majority really is pushing for a fiscal plan, a long-range fiscal plan, and I appreciate that. There's some definitely some conflicts with the Senate over that, what taxes or additional revenues are needed, but we have to step up to the plate sooner rather than later.
And I want to share with you real quick a story that highlights exactly Mike's point. About a year and a half ago, I was invited to the Atwood building by the governor and his office. To sit with about 50 business leaders in a conference room. The governor rolled out his permanent fund plan. This was in October of 2015. You had 60 business leaders, a lot of those politically active. And after about an hour and a half of listening to people, you know, complain, finally, there was a gentleman across the room in the oil field service. And he started in on the governor about, oh, when you people cut the budget, you only cut mid-managers, you only cut the road graders, you don't cut upper management. And I thought to myself, okay, just 4 months ago, the Department of Transportation had to come up with over $10 million to reopen the North Slope Road after it flooded. I mean, who pays for that, right? And so finally, I just spoke up and I said, look, you know, we're all complaining about the same thing, the lack of fiscal stability in the state. Here's a suggestion. Stop donating to the very same people that have driven us to this point. Because, you know, you donate to these folks every year. They go down to Juneau. This is what they've done. They put the entire economy and every person around that room's business at risk. And we just keep endorsing and electing the same people. And it doesn't make any sense.
Well, on that note, let's go back to the phones. We have a lot of callers on the line. Mike is in Petersburg. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. People keep talking about an income tax, and it seems like these guys dance around the issue. I mean, how simple would it be to put an income tax? And they're talking about 20% of the money made in Alaska comes from out of state. I think the number is much higher. The majority of our cannery workers all up and down the coast, from Ketchikan to Bristol Bay, come from outside the state. The North Slope, a great many of them, a very high percentage of the people there, are from out of state. The IFQ program, both for halibut and black cod, a very high percentage of those IFQ owners come from out of state. The permits held by folks from Bristol Bay to Southeastern, a very high percentage of those permits are owned by folks from out of state. They bring their boats in, they bring their crews in, and they make their money here, and they turn around and go home and donate very little. The ferry system has a high percentage of folks from out of state. I mean, I could go on and on and on, and I don't know why we dance around this issue. I don't know why they don't just impose a state income tax, which would help a great deal. I could go on and on about other issues, but I think this is one of the simplest ways to raise money for the state.
Well, thank you, Mike. So we've heard a few different people saying skin in the game, income tax, and we had an email. We've got many calls and also lots of emails. And this one from Gail says, keep in mind that when you're cutting the budget and employees are cut in the state government, the work doesn't go away. It falls on remaining employees. And Gail says this can be demoralizing to those employees, especially when the public expects the same level of service. We are going to take a very quick break and come back and have more conversation about the way forward for the state of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We have a lot of calls, and I want to get to a few more of those. But I also wanted to ask our guest today, Mike Navarre, a former Democrat, House member, and also the Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor and a business owner, and Andrew Helcrow, who is former Republican House member and is the CEO of the Anchorage... I have to get the name right here. What is it
again?
Community
Development.
Community
Authority,
Development.
Yes.
I'm so sorry. I wanted to say economic development, but I knew that wasn't right. Community Development, and also a business owner. So what we've heard a lot of call about income taxes and that we need to get other business done. What in your minds is the next thing that's the most pressing? Is it the capital budget, or what should lawmakers address in the short term? Now that there's no longer a risk of a government shutdown?
Well, I was a little concerned about the capital budget not passing, but I talked with the governor's office and head of OMB, and what they actually said is there's no real urgency to it. It does need to pass, but they rolled a few of the immediate needs in the capital budget into the operating budget that passed as part of the compromise. So there's a little time there. You know, really, it takes additional communication. I think it takes additional outreach to the public by the governor's office or by supporters of what the governor's trying to do for a long-range fiscal plan. Certainly, I'm one of them that intend to speak out even more. I've done it around our communities on the Kenai Peninsula, and I think it's resonated fairly well about the need for a plan. But what it takes in the legislature is communication, which I think is ongoing, cooperation, and compromise. And those last two, we haven't reached a critical stage on yet, and we really need to focus on working together. You know, that's how things, it seems, when I was younger and even when I was in the legislature, when we had crises, people pulled together. Now politics has become so polarized that we end up gravitating towards the extremes on one side or the other, and you can't do that. You've got to come together in the middle and figure out a responsible plan.
And there are two things. I would absolutely agree with Mike, because when I think back 14, 15 years ago when I was in the legislature with Ethan Berkowitz, Lisa Murkowski, Eric Croft, those folks, there was a recognition that you had to have votes on both sides of the aisle to pass anything. And it was a torturous process. I mean, we argued between income and sales tax. We argued about taking the taking permanent fund earnings, but how much? So it's a complex problem to solve. As Mike said, you have to have communication, and you need, because you're always going to have some Republicans who won't vote for anything and some Democrats that won't vote for anything. So the key is finding that common ground. There are four solutions. The solution to the state's fiscal dilemma is in four parts. Number one, you have to constrain the cost of government and start getting better results, right? Stop complaining to me about how much money you spend in education and tell me what you're doing to improve outcomes, right? Expectations. The second thing is you need to use permanent fund earnings. The gap is too big to not use permanent fund earnings. The third thing is you need a broad-based tax, because there's not enough to take the permanent fund and not damage the economy. You need a broad-based tax to fill the gap and to finally get people to pay for the services they deserve. And the fourth and final step is you have to develop our resources more aggressively. Mm. We're a resource development state. You have to start pushing ahead with some of these developments, and the state has a role to play in that with economic sustainability.
Let's go back to the phones. Herman is in Aniak. Hi, Herman.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I kind of disagree with what you guys are saying. First of all, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, first of all, by saying you have to take the dividend by tapping the fund, you drove 15,000 Alaskans to live below the poverty level. You took away most of the other incomes, and it's all about big government now and how we're going to pay for it. The governor before he ran said he wouldn't touch the permanent fund, and then he said, a big guy didn't take it all. And now they're saying they have to spend it for us, to save it for us. It seems like they're already planning on spending it, but they're going in the wrong direction. They could cut the budget, the schools. Do we really need 57 superintendents here in Alaska for the small population we have? And look how much money we're spending on education because of them lobbyists. No wonder our new president wants to do with some of them lobbyists, They need to do their part, too. and these oil tax credits, you know, don't take it away. We need the oil companies. Maybe cut it by one fourth so they could do their part. But reinstate that permanent fund to the people. In my community, I think there's 550. They took $660,000 from our community. Mm-hmm. You multiply that by every community in Alaska. Look what you guys are doing.
Well, Herman, thank you so much for raising those points. And it's very important for us to hear from rural Alaska and, you know, off the road communities that that do rely heavily on not only the permanent fund, but probably are paying some local taxes in their communities. Mike Navarre.
Well, and we often hear about why it costs so much in Alaska for government in Alaska. And the reality is we have a very large state, very small population. Economies of scale that apply elsewhere in the country just don't apply in Alaska. It's very expensive to maintain an airport in a rural community. It's very expensive to maintain schools and pay for the cost of education and transportation, et cetera, in rural communities. And so those folks in the rural communities who are frustrated about having the dividends cut have to recognize that there is no fiscal plan that's responsible that doesn't use a portion of earnings of the permanent fund. We can't just use it to pay dividends. We've got to use it in order to support spending decisions, many of which directly impact those same folks in rural communities for health care, for transportation, for education, those types of things that are a big part of the spending in rural Alaska.
And I want to address Herman's point about, you know, I hear this a lot, you got to spend it to save it. The reality is that's correct. I mean, look at what they just did, which drew $2.5 billion or so from the CBR. Another year, you're going to be into the earnings reserve. That's where the dividends get calculated. So unless you come up with a fiscal plan that reworks the financial structure, in another couple of years, you're going to lose the dividend. So when people say you got to spend it to save it, meaning you need to combine those accounts and start generating revenue, because if you keep drawing from the CBR and then the earnings reserve, there will be no dividend.
What's your level of concern in our final moment here, which isn't enough time? We've got calls stacked up that we're not going to get to. Sorry about that. The Medicaid expansion that Governor Walker decided to go ahead and do. Now we're seeing legislation come out of both the National Congress, House and Senate, that will pull back those Medicaid dollars. Mike Navarre, you're a borough manager. What's your concern about this?
Huge concern. The borough owns two hospitals, and we own a hospital in Homer, South Peninsula Hospital, and in Soldotna, Central Peninsula Hospital. Well, we rely a lot on the Medicaid program, Medicare program. And so what it's really managed to do, Medicaid expansion has done, is helped pay for some of the charity care and uncompensated care that was being picked up by other payers and users of the healthcare system. So it was an important program, and healthcare is incredibly important individually to families, but at the same time, it is ridiculously expensive in Alaska. It's not sustainable, but pulling the plug and reducing spending on Medicaid, it's not the answer. We need to reform that system a little bit, but we can't just cut it.
Right. But and 15 seconds or so?
Yeah, and I want to echo what Mike said, because 25% of Alaskans are on Medicaid. That's one in four people in this state. Not fixing the problem is a huge economic disaster.
Well, thank you so much. We could have went for 2 hours, as is often the case on this program in these lively discussions. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Helcrow and Mike Navarre. Thanks for the great attention by phone and email. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, Wesley Early on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
To further their commitment to sustainable practices, Alaska Pacific University hosts a farmers market located at the Carr Gottstein Building every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. They have produce from APU's Spring Creek Farm, Alaska-grown produce, baked goods, and community activities. WIC and senior coupons honored. Find out more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.